Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today's topic is noise pollution. We're learning how it impacts both humans and animals, and we have a couple of guests for you. One is Amanda Shermer. Amanda is head of wildlife rehabilitation at Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua. She holds a Wisconsin Advanced Wildlife Rehabilitation License and is a graduate of UW Stevens Point. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you with us. With us as well, Dr. Beth Neary. Dr. Neary is a pediatrician, a member of the Council of Environmental Health of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and co-president of the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network. She attended UW School of Medicine and Public Health, did her pediatric residency at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Neary practiced general pediatrics in Madison and is now devoted to environmental issues and health. Dr. Neary, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry.
As we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in. Maybe your neighborhood is noisy. How noisy is it? Let us know if you've seen animals reacting to loud noises or how sounds have affected your health. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Neary, let's start with you. How do you define noise pollution as you run into it in the medical field?
So noise is basically an unwanted sound or disturbing sound that affects health or well-being. Actually, noise is an invisible danger, and it's actually considered the second largest environmental cause of health problems after air pollution.
Man, how do we measure it? We measure it, I assume, in decibels.
Yes, well, let me talk about that a little bit. So listeners can have their own impression. You can think of yourself sitting in the yard, and you listen to the cardinal chirping, and all of a sudden you hear an overhead roar of a jet plane or somebody using a power tool. So sound is a vibration. So it has frequency or pitch. It has intensity or loudness that is measured in decibels. It has periodicity, which means a continuous, like a hum, like an air conditioner, versus an impulse sound, like a gun. And then it has duration, so length of time. And let me just refresh you how the sound gets to our brain.
Okay.
So the sound waves enter the ear canal, they vibrate the eardrum, then the vibration travels to the three tiny bones in the middle ear that amplifies the vibration. That causes a wave of fluid in the inner ear that has fluid in it, that's the cochlea, and it stimulates these fine little hair cells. And then each hair cell responds to a specific frequency, and then it converts that sound to a nerve impulse, travels via the auditory nerve, go to the brain, and then we interpret the sound. So it really goes to the brain. We listen in the brain.
Well, my little hair fibers were really vibrating the other night when I was sitting on the porch, and a young couple went by with the windows open, and that was the loudest music that I had heard. And I mean, you could hear it all the way down the block. Oh, my goodness me. To me, that was...
Can I add one more thing to talk about the anatomy and physiology? So impulse noises, like the noise from a gunshot or a firecracker, are actually the most harmful to the human ear. And that's because we have a reflex. It's called the acoustic reflex. I won't go into it, but it actually dampens the vibration of the sound via the smallest muscle in the body, the stapedius muscle. It measures 1 millimeter, but it can't protect us from the sudden intense noise of like a gunshot or a firecracker.
That is really interesting. I had not heard that. I want to hear how each of you became aware of noise pollution. And Dr. Neary, let's keep going with you for a minute. Then we'll go to Amanda Shermer. You're co-president of the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network. Tell us more about that group.
Okay, our group, it's a group of health professionals, and our role is to link environmental issues to health issues. We advocate, we sometimes testify at the Capitol on bills. I've testified on bills related to lead, other chemicals. We actually teach future physicians. We educate the public because we're learning more and more that environmental issues truly affect human health, whether it's lead, PFAS, noise, air pollution. And with climate change, we're learning more and more about air pollution affecting health.
So you're dealing with a whole broad range of things. When it comes to decreasing noise pollution in our state, how's the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network been involved with that?
We were involved in speaking out on the impact of noise when the there were some issues, the F-35s coming to Madison, and we got involved there talking about what the impact would be on children and learning, because there's a significant number of low-income families that live near the airport and a number of schools in the area. So that's how we initially got involved.
Let's turn to Amanda for a few minutes. Amanda, I mentioned you're director of wildlife rehabilitation at the Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua. And maybe first just describe the center for us.
We're located up here in Minocqua, Wisconsin. We've been functioning here since 1978, I believe. So we've been here for quite some time. We started from next door. The veterinarian at the time that was working there was Rory Foster. And he kind of got involved because people were finding injured and orphaned wildlife and didn't know what to do and were dropping them off at his vet clinic. And it really, the one that really kicked it off was a fawn they called Faylene that was hit by a car, had a broken leg. They were able to fix her up and release her, and they were continuing to see there was such a huge need for wildlife rehabilitation in the state, especially in an area like this where we have a lot of wildlife and people interacting on a regular basis. So that's kind of how we started here, and we've we've been rehabilitating ever since. We've also added an education department as well. We do a lot of educating with a lot of young children and even adults throughout the year. We have just this weekend we'll be opening our tours back up by reservation, where we have some non-releasable wildlife that we use as educational ambassadors to help teach people about nature and how we can all be better about living, coexisting together. And things like that. So that's kind of what we do here. We are open all year round, usually admitting animals from about 8 to 5 every day. So we're just getting kicked on us, you know, the baby season's just getting kick-started here, and it started a bit early just due to a very warm winter we have here, and we're already up, our calls this year up about 80% from last year, and we're up about 40% on admissions. So we're just now training our summer interns in. We have about 8 of them every year, so they're here to help us take care of all the animals because we're admitting up to 500 a year that we're admitting for care. That's kind of here.
Yeah, that's a lot of animals. You know, you think about Minocqua, some might consider Minocqua to be in a quieter part of the state, although I've been in Minocqua in July, and it's kind of noisy then. But Minocqua's in the Northwoods. When you notice noise pollution in your area, where's typically is it coming from?
Typically, it's human caused. So anywhere we're seeing people coming in. So we have a lot of lakes up here in Minocqua, the Minocqua, Greater Minocqua area. So we have a lot of animals that live the lake life. But unfortunately, sometimes people also like to live the lake life, and it's boat traffic and boat noise will be disruptive to them. I know it's even disruptive to even our fish and things like that. We don't think about how that noise is disruptive. I know we're just getting started in the loon nesting season. That's a big one. Unfortunately, boats do like to look at the loon nest, and it causes a lot of noise, and unfortunately at times causes them to abandon the nest and things like that. So that's mainly where we're seeing it on the lakes. We're also, you mentioned 4th of July up here. That is a time where We get a lot of animals in due to that noise disruption. Those fireworks shows that are going off cause a lot of times eagles to fledge the nest too soon. They're jumping out of those nests because for us it's a firework. For them it's kind of like a bomb. They're unaware it's coming. So, you know, those start firing off at night when it's supposed to be at its most quiet and causes them to jump. So you can see injuries because they can't quite fly yet, so they're not able to catch themselves coming down from the top of those trees. We also get a lot of lost fawns that unfortunately, when those fireworks go off, you're seeing the doe go one way and the fawn go another, and due to the level of the noise, they travel quite far, and sometimes we can't get them back together, so they're trying to come in here for care. So we see a lot of different noise pollution. Even at the smaller level as well, you know, sometimes birds don't always pick the best place to nest. If it is in a busy area where people are at, the mother may be forced to abandon a nest. And the babies are alone. Luckily, we are here to, you know, take in those babies when they're found. But unfortunately, a lot of the times it's in areas where we don't even know they're there. So it's being aware of what's around you, and we're all having a good time, but your noise is impacting the world around you as well.
You know, I've got to believe that most animals are sensitive, pretty sensitive to noise and noise pollution.
Yes. One place where we commonly see it, even in our own homes, is a lot of people are reporting their dogs and cats being sensitive to sounds and that causing them anxiety. When anything new happens, or, you know, the neighbors, something goes off in the neighbor's yard, a car backfires that their dogs are running off. They have a much better sense of hearing than we do. They use those differently than we do, so they're hearing things louder or in different ways that we are. You also have animals like frogs that don't have the outward ear. They have the drum type thing, and turtles like that, so they're hearing sounds differently. They can, you know, kind of hear you walking up based on vibrations they're feeling. A lot of animals have a lot of different types of ears, so they're hearing things differently and it impacts them differently. And oftentimes more than we are.
Yeah.
You know, we've all kind of acclimated to our noise versus animals have not.
And Dr. Neary, I saw you nodding in agreement there. Do you have something to add there?
Oh, yeah, and when I was doing some of my research, it said that 26 million Americans have high-frequency hearing loss caused by exposure to loud sounds from their leisure activity. That means athletic events, rock concerts, bands, using the snowmobile. So as she's talking about the animals, I'm thinking about how in our recreation we're doing this to ourselves, too.
Yeah.
What I found was I was looking at like all the ways we're exposed to different sounds. And what's interesting to me is now that I have an Apple Watch, it tells me when I'm in a loud environment. So here I am at the UW volleyball games and my watch keeps going off. So now I wear earplugs when I go to the volleyball games. And the other thing to think about is this was fascinating to me. There's a 13-year-old girl named Nora Keegan from Canada. He did a science fair project measuring the automatic hand dryers in 40 public restrooms in Canada and found that over half of them were over 100 decibels. And then when you think of a child, they're like right under that thing when they dry their hands. So I think we just need to think more about how we are exposed to sound in our environment.
I would agree. And I back to the animals again. I read a report, I think Clara Niper gave it to me, of some research done on owls and how noise pollution, just a slight increase in noise pollution can greatly impact an owl's ability to hunt at night. Because their hearing, Amanda, is pretty good.
Yeah, they have spectacular hearing. They actually have, you know, when we bring them into rehab, we always like to show the interns their ears because they kind of look like giant holes in their head. They're just huge. You can actually see the back of the eye through the ear. It's so big. And they're actually also offset. So versus, you know, when we look at our head, our ears are even where ear holes are. Theirs are offset, and that's why you see them doing the funny head motions. It's called triangulating. So they're able to kind of figure out where these noises are coming from. And they can hear a mouse under a foot of snow, some of these owls, or they can hear little mice under the ground and they're waiting for them to come out of these holes or shuffling underneath the leaf litter. And so they can pinpoint very small sounds from a pretty decent distance. You know, they could be halfway up a tree, exactly where it is, and pounce down on that mouse and get it. And sometimes in light that they can't see barely at all, they're doing all of this by hearing, and they're able to catch that mouse. So you can imagine that when you're trying to listen to those fine, tiny noises like that, it doesn't take much to not be able to hear them.
So, well, I think a 1 or 2 degree decibel increase in this research show would cut an owl's ability by about 8% to finding food. So it's nothing to sneeze at for sure. Dr. Beth Neary, our guest today, pediatrician, co-president of the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network, and Amanda Shermer, director of wildlife rehabilitation at Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua. Join in with your questions and comments. Number to call 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Clara Neipert, our producer, Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Taking a look at noise pollution today and how it affects us as humans, but also how it affects our animals and our wildlife with our two guests, Dr. Beth Neary and Amanda Shermer. Great to have them along. You can join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org. John in Pleasant Prairie, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I'm in Pleasant Prairie. I live in a kind of a area called Carroll Beach, which is on the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the houses. Anyway, our problem is, it seems to be more now year-round, motorcycles and cars that sound like they don't have mufflers on them take over especially during the summer. They take over Sheridan Road and, you know, other roads, you know, as they're, you know, places where they feel they can open up their throttles and speed as well as make a lot of noise. And personally, on our property, it's like of a bird sanctuary. And when these large, you know, these cars and trucks and motorcycles rev up their engines, because there's stop signs, you know, quite a bit in the area. So they have to, most of them stop. A lot of people go through stop signs. But when they stop, if they stop, what do? They rev up their bikes and cars. And so that adds more noise. And in terms of the birds, they fly away because they don't know what that noise is.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. Amanda Shermer, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sometimes that noise, that one's a hard one to deal with because, you know, I deal with that here too at the center. We're located here in town. Unfortunately, we do have like an ATV trail that runs nearby. They can go along the road to get between ATV trails, and they come up along the fence and they don't realize there's animals on the other side, and they're revving their engines for no reason. They could just drive by, and instead they're playing around. And again, it goes back to that recreational noise that unfortunately we're having a good time and we don't realize what we're doing to the world around us and just needing to be conscious. Those birds, they're flying out of there. I wouldn't know this for sure, but I bet you're seeing less nests around. You're seeing less bird activity overall. There's some species that learn to handle it better than others. So there's species that tend to like the more seclusive areas, the quiet areas. Probably really you're not seeing those species. So it's probably definitely having an impact on what you're seeing there. Unfortunately, you're probably seeing more of what is thought to be the common birds, but they're the ones that are able to acclimate to people being around more often than others. So, yeah, I can imagine the type of impact it's having, and if anybody in the area likes to do any birding, either from their window at a bird feeder or actively searching out species, I'd imagine it's not a great place to see them, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Can I add something, Larry?
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Neri.
I did a little research on this, and we actually have a statute in Wisconsin, 347.39, that says that you have to have adequate muffler to prevent excessive noise or annoying sounds. But I read that a number of people actually put on an aftermarket muffler to increase the sound. So we have a statute, but actually we don't enforce it.
Yeah.
So that's a problem.
Yeah, and if somebody like John would call the local, sheriff, I mean, what do you do? Because the motorcycles are there and gone, or other loud vehicles, they're there and gone. So how are you going to deal with it? No doubt.
You know what they do in Paris, Larry? They actually have what's called noise cameras. They measure the sound of the vehicles, and then they find them. They send them a ticket in the mail.
Oh!
There's ways.
There's ways to do it, John. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Neil in Minnesota will go to you. Hi, Neil.
Hi, good morning. So often on new pavement, on roadway projects, they'll install rumble strips along the highway for safety reasons. Maybe they have a high amount of crashes in that area from cars leaving the roadway. But of course, the intent of that is to alert the driver. And on the flip side, it also creates noise pollution, I suppose, for the folks that live in that area. And, how do you balance, the need for that, the safety, versus the compared to the, the limiting the noise for the people that live in that vicinity?
Yeah. Dr. Neri, maybe comment?
Well, I want to get my comments in on what the impact is on children. If as a pediatrician, I really need to get that in there.
Oh, yeah, we'll get that in. Don't worry.
and effects on human health.
Yeah. Well, Neil, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Kenosha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, can you hear me? Just kidding. Hey, before I talk about my snowmobile experience, I want to mention I really appreciate learning about these animal hearing. It's so fascinating, and I've learned about humans, too, that if it's as good as it can get, otherwise we'd be listening to our heartbeat. So thank heavens for hearing. So in out west, most notably Wyoming, I did some experiments with my snowmobile because I was so worried about disturbing the wildlife, and I would get ahead of my friends, stop, take off my helmet, take off my earplugs because I needed earplugs for the snowmobile, turn off my snowmobile, and then listen to the folks coming, and I'll tell you, it was not that bad. They had to get really close to hear it. Now, I will say I was wide open space. It was the Gravant Junction, and it was very wide open space. So maybe when you're going through woods and echoes, it might be different. But I think there's a little bit of a myth about the devastation of snowmobile noise, and I'll take the answer off air. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, let's go to Amanda Shermer for that. Hi, Amanda.
Yeah, that one's a hard one because would it be loud enough to cause hearing loss in them? No. You know, it may not be, but what it could be doing is disrupting them from their everyday activities. Again, you have the owls. It doesn't take much to disrupt them from being able to eat, and unfortunately, they don't have a local grocery store to go to get food. So if they're not catching it, unfortunately, they're not eating. And especially during those cold times of the season where there's snow out there, they need food to keep thermoregulating correctly. So sometimes it doesn't take as much. You know, as people, again, we're really acclimated to our own noise. So when the power goes out, I don't know about anybody else, but even at night I wake up because my house is quiet, and it's supposed to be quiet at night. But in reality, we're always hearing the buzz of all the electronics plugged in. You're hearing the buzz of the refrigerator. Even like the electricity in your wall has a buzz, and we don't perceive it anymore because it is our everyday noise we hear. You know, we always talk about like chronic and acute injuries and caused by stress. So these animals that aren't hearing that every day, snowmobiles going by once in a while, you're going to have acute type of stress going on. So it's there, it's gone. It's probably not going to cause them any issues, but especially in the areas where there's a lot of snowmobiles going by all day long, you know, especially here in northern Wisconsin, there's trails where there's snowmobiles on them at all times almost when the season's really going. That's more of a chronic stress. And chronic stress can actually be more detrimental to your body than acute stress. So it's not like somebody scared you and you got that adrenaline rush and it was gone. It's when you're a little bit of adrenaline is going all the time. It really can affect your heart and your overall state of mind, as well as just your overall health. So that's really what the thing I always like to talk about is, remember, noise can cause these animals stress, and that stress over time can cause some negative effects for them.
And as I understand it, you and your co-workers at the Northwoods Wildlife Center think a lot about noise when you decide where to place an animal's enclosure or even whether to speak in the presence of an animal. Tell us more about those considerations.
Absolutely. A great example is we had our first fawns that came in this year. Unfortunately, their mom was hit along the roadway, and they had been there with the mother, so there was confirmed they had no mother anymore, so they were brought in for care, and it had been really quiet here for a couple of days. They had started eating really well for us, you know, letting us care for them, but for the most part, we keep them isolated from ourselves so they don't imprint on us. They had each other as company so they can remember that they're deer and not people, because that can cause them a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of issues in the future if they're socializing more with people than with other deer. But we had a large school group come through, and they weren't even really housed that close to it. They were on the other side of a noise barrier fence and everything. But we noticed during that tour they did not like the extra noise of the little kids shuffling by in the rocks, and, you know, little kids are always giggling and, you know, the teachers telling them to stay in line and things like that. And, like, the extra tour noise, they did not eat the entire time those students were here. And even later that day, we noticed they were not eating well. They were much spookier. You could tell they were uncomfortable. They were stressed. They were having these stress responses that we weren't seeing prior to that. So it was strictly that noise. And it really wasn't even noise that was out of the ordinary. It wasn't like cars backfiring and revving noises. It was just people going by and talking that was causing these poor fawns stress. It was out of the normal. It wasn't what they normally heard. And it was an event that happened for 1 hour, and it affected them for the rest of the day. They didn't start eating well until about mid the next day after that. So it affected them for a long period of time. So
yeah,
we definitely that.
Well, talking about baby deer reminds me to get back to Dr. Neary, as she's talking about other kinds of babies, the human kinds of babies. You had you've done some research on toddlers, and well, go ahead and talk about your research.
Okay, so in children, we know that excessive noise can cause delays in speech comprehension, language learning, reduce attention, impaired concentration. There was actually a study in Europe that was done in three airports, one by Amsterdam, one by Madrid, and one in London. And they looked at reading comprehension in 2009 and 10-year-olds. And they found that aircraft noise was linearly associated with impaired reading comprehension, and it was consistent across all three countries. So we know it impairs learning for children. And it's so important that children hear very well so that they can learn language. And then if we talk about adults, we think about the same concept that that you were talking about in animals, that noise creates stress. So we elicit the cortisol, which increases blood pressure, which induces inflammation, affecting the blood vessels, going on to have a cascade of cardiovascular disease. We know that nighttime aircraft noise actually has a higher risk of hypertension. So that interrupted sleep. Sleep is so important to health, and we're learning more and more about that. And one other thing I wanted to mention, that there was a study in The Lancet. It linked hearing loss in midlife to dementia. And they said that hearing loss is the largest modifiable factor in the development of dementia. So genetics is not modifiable. We can't do anything about that. But hearing is so important that if you detect that you're having some trouble with your hearing, go get it tested. And if you need to get a hearing aid, do it, because it actually can prevent, at least they said, 8% of dementia. So that's really important for human health.
Yeah, it certainly is. Pete in Maquanago emailed us. They've noticed a trend in their neighborhood as neighbors utilize power tools, you know, grinding metal or circular saws. They've noticed on several occasions that somehow is a cue for a Cooper's hawk to enter the area and begin to be a predator. Any ideas or thoughts on that, Amanda Sherber?
Yeah, my thought would be, when these power tools are going off, you have songbirds that are quietly sitting somewhere, quietly feeding, going about their normal activity, and then that power tool coming up on causes them to want to flee. So all of a sudden, there's a lot of little birds in the air flying about looking to escape the noise. And Cooper's hawk, which is a bird of prey that naturally predates on other birds. So that means all his food sources are now flying about, out in the open, panicking and not looking for him, but instead trying to escape that noise. So that is a distraction that unfortunately may cause the demise of a couple of those birds. So my thought it would be that he is taking advantage of those other birds fleeing and being stressed and being distracted by that noise to get a quick meal.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good answer to that. Emma in the town of Dunn, we'll go to you now. Hi, Emma.
Hello. I am calling because I have a question about air brakes. I'm not sure if you would know the answer, but, in some places it'll say no air brakes. And I'm wondering why we need to have, you know, what is it about the air brakes that sometimes they need to do something with them and sometimes they don't?
I'm not sure myself, but maybe Dr. Neary, a comment on that? No?
I don't know. What's an air brake? I don't know what that is.
It's a very loud noise. It makes a very loud noise when a semi or a large vehicle lets... I don't know how it actually happens, but it is a very, very loud noise. And I would imagine, Amanda, it would have, I don't know if you ever have air brake sounds where you are, but it would have an impact on animals.
Yeah, you know, I've always heard them referred to as J-brakes. That's another way I've heard it about. But yeah, it's a very unpleasant noise. Recently we were driving in the middle of town. I had a few obligations the last couple of days, and I was driving somewhere else in a different town, and we were waiting at a roundabout, and all of a sudden the semi comes up and just, you know, puts on those air brakes, and it was very loud, and we were in a residential area. And to me it seemed a little unnecessary that he had to be using that type of braking system right then. Maybe he could have come up a little bit slower. I know usually I've seen it when they're carrying those big heavy loads. Like he was a logging truck full of logs, so that, you know what I mean, to get that stop power, but could he have stopped a little sooner? My thing is, yeah, it's very disruptive to both people and
animals. Marie in Wausau has something for Dr. Neary. Let's go there. Hi, Marie.
Hi, thanks so much. And if Dr. Neary, if you could mention again what organization you're working with, because I really appreciate there's kind of an organized approach to this. And then my second comment along those lines is, thank you guys for raising awareness of this. I am the person who disconnected the ice maker on my refrigerator because I hated hearing it go off. And my husband looked at me like I was nuts because he doesn't even hear it. So some of us, especially migranters, we're just the people who know, you know, hear all these things. And so I think recognizing that just like different animals appreciate it differently, different people appreciate it differently. And I am seeing my teenager's new boyfriend souped up his car and he turns it on in the driveway and I can feel the boom, boom, boom. So as you're talking about those aftermarket mufflers, but he didn't laugh at her at all that when she went to watch the car races, she wore earmuffs. And she said that probably 30% of the kids there were wearing earmuffs at the car races up here in Wausau last week. And I thought that was pretty neat that the people who aren't bothered by the noise are respecting that some people are.
Yeah. Marie, well, thank you for calling. Dr. Beth Neary, comments?
So, Marie, yes, you make some really good points there, that there are individual variabilities in how we perceive sound. So you turning off the ice maker, you must have very good hearing. So, and I think it's wonderful that the young people are wearing things to protect their ears. I always like it when I see people put that on their children's ears, too. The organization that we're with is the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network. And actually, we were up in the Wausau area last year talking about PFAS in your community. So we like to advocate for the health of all of Wisconsin.
And across a broad range of things, as you say, PFAS, but hearing and other things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Marie, thank you so much for calling. Our guests today, Dr. Beth Neary, pediatrician, a member of the Council on Environmental Health of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and co-president of the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network. With us as well, Amanda Shermer, director of wildlife rehabilitation at Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at noise pollution and hearing loss and how it affects our animals as well as our people here on the show. And our two guests, Dr. Beth Neary and Amanda Shermer, Dr. Neary, a pediatrician, Amanda Shermer, director of wildlife rehabilitation at Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Jeff in Pelican Lake, we'll go to you. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Oh, thank you very much. My complaint is I think you got a new sound engineer working for your station. And when you do your breaks in between programs, they play film music, and sometimes that film music has that low, loud bass. It's the same as like when the kids go by with their cars with that loud bass. And it, to me, in my car, I actually turn the station because I don't know how long that film music is going to go on with that heavy beat and that heavy bass. I also might have to say, well, one of the reasons I might be sensitive to it is I'm a Vietnam vet and I also suffer from PTSD. So maybe that contributes to it too.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you so much for calling. I imagine that could be the case, Dr. Neary.
Yeah, Jeff, you bring up a good point. There are more sensitive populations in the human population, like yourself, with PTSD and children and infants. And in fact, we learned this with our children or premature babies in the intensive care unit. We noticed when there is more noise from all the machines beeping and alarming that their heart rates would go up. And so now they've instituted quiet times in the newborn intensive care unit so the babies can sleep and rest. So you yourself and babies and others are more sensitive to sound.
Jeff, thank you very much for calling. And another person wanted additional comments on the noise pollution-related health conditions other than hearing loss, things like maybe high blood pressure or something like that, Dr. Neary.
Yes. Yeah, there's been a lot more research involving that, for sure. It's related to an increase in stress hormones, like I said, that actually release the cortisol, that increase blood pressure, and then have an effect on our arteries. So yes, it is linked to cardiovascular disease. And the interruption of sleep is very important. And that in turn affects mental health. So it's key in cardiovascular disease and mental health.
Wondering what, I don't want to miss out on this. I'm wondering what can we do? Maybe what do you do? Let's say the animals first and then talk about the people. What can we do to decrease the sound issues, Amanda Shermer? Maybe what do you do and what do you recommend people do to kind of cut back on the noise where they live?
Yeah, the biggest thing we could do is our own actions. Unfortunately, we can't control other people, but it's the decisions we make every day. You know, if you have a radio playing while you're out in the garage working or doing some yard work, like, does it need to be that loud? Can we turn those noises down? You know, any unnecessary noises that we don't have to be going, maybe don't forget the radio on as you go in to go eat lunch, maybe turn it off. Those kind of noises, being conscious about if we are doing recreational activities, how we're disrupting those animals in, out on the lakes or, you know, out in the woods when we're doing ATV trails, just being aware of the world around us and how we're affecting us can do a big, you know, have a big effect. And also, you know, when you see other people doing something, you know, your friends and your family, it doesn't hurt to mention it. You're like, oh, yeah, that's really loud. Can we turn it down? It doesn't mean you can't do anything. It just means maybe we should turn it down. Even around 4th of July, that's a time of the year for wildlife that can be very traumatic and be very hard on them. So leaving the fireworks shows to your local municipal that are having these large shows and maybe not firing off as many fireworks in your own yard or at your own parties, leaving that. So these big events are happening only in certain areas versus just widespread. I know we could all experience that, you know, our dogs or ourselves, you're trying to sleep and your neighbor is having a party. Being aware that there's other people that may not be doing the same thing as you and just trying to keep it down a little bit more.
Yeah. I think there may be some things that we can do. Dr. Neary, you want to add it something here, too?
Yeah, I think we are doing some really good things for those of us that are using electric power tools. So I now have a lithium snowblower. It doesn't make half the sound that the old snowblower did. Easier to push too. You can use a lawnmower that's electric and leaf blowers too. So it's better for both noise pollution and air pollution. More green space. So the more grass we have and trees that buffers the noise. Like Amanda said, you know, be kind and be considerate. Think of your neighbors. And humans, we can wear earplugs and things like that. Unfortunately, animals can't do that.
Yeah. This year I bought a new battery operated lawnmower, mm-hmm. and it is so much quieter.
And easier to push too, Larry, I got to admit, on the hill.
It is indeed. By the way, just on another matter, Jim in Kenosha says it's not air braking, it's engine braking. And I think Amanda, you were kind of getting at that too. It's engine braking that makes the noise and the signs. And they do post signs, but they're to keep the neighbors quiet, not for the animals. But if it would work for the people, it would be working for the animals as well. Peter in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, just a real quick comment. You had a guy on a little while ago who was saying that snowmobiles weren't that bad. And listening to his statement, he said he got off his snowmobile, turned it off, and the first thing he did was take out his earplugs. If it's not that bad, why would you need earplugs?
Okay. Yeah, it's in my, and I don't even know if they make, I guess they're making electric snowmobiles now. And I don't know if those are any, probably less noisy than the others. But you make a good point there, Peter. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Well, we've got a lot more that I think that we can talk about. If you live in a high traffic area, this is a real problem, and especially if you have young people, if you got young kids, and you're in a high traffic area, I think some of your comments, Dr. Beth Neary, relating to cutting back the sound with hedges, with trees and that sort of thing can make a difference. Is there anything else we can do? I hate keeping my windows closed. Especially, as we get into this time of the year.
Well, the other thing is, some cities and towns have ordinances. So I know that the city of Madison has an ordinance for construction. So you can't start construction before 7 a.m. or you can't do it after 7 p.m. So there's some communities that have noise ordinances.
Noise ordinances aren't a bad idea at all. Amanda Shermer, what do you think?
Back to the noise ordinance things, it's easy to ignore them. Sometimes it's hard to enforce them in some ways, but just keeping in mind that those ordinances are there for a reason, and they should be respected for a reason, because those rules aren't put on just to put on rules. There's a reason why something was found out, that noise is having an issue, and this, again, going back to being respectful. I really like the thought of making more green space, because and I feel like in Wisconsin and even the United States, we're getting more aware of how much blacktop and how much hard surface we have, and in that green space, like, biodiversity matters. Keeping those green spaces is an awesome way of going. We are gearing away from any sort of snow removal that, our normal stuff has a battery operated snow blower and a leaf blower and stuff like that. So there is a lot of different options out there that really help.
Your group does a fair amount of education as well, does it not? Describe a little about that.
Yeah, we do education here. We educate about wildlife. We have a red-tailed hawk that often travels to school groups. She's glove-trained, was non-releasable. We also have a selection of turtles and other reptiles as well that go along. But we actually don't only do wildlife education. We do nature in the whole. Even frog calls we're talking about. We have rocks. We talk about our rock program and even things like that. So it's like nature in itself. We do try to get at noise sometimes and how that affects us, our everyday behavior and the negative things that it does. That's definitely something that does come up in there. Because oftentimes a lot of animals, such as owl, are trying to be silent, and that can be affected by what we do.
Yeah, it certainly can. Well, I tell you what, it's been interesting for me. I think it has been for everybody listening as well to hear both of you talk today. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. And hopefully we'll be able to do this again down the road. Thank you both very much. Appreciate you having the time to be with us today. Dr. Beth Neary, one of our guests, pediatrician, a member of the Council on Environmental Health and the American Academy of Pediatrics. And Dr. Neary is co-president of the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network. Amanda Shermer, Director of Wildlife Rehabilitation at Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua, and I urge you to take a look at their website. Just type in Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua, and you're going to find it. And maybe you can volunteer or maybe even donate. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and our topic is ageism in healthcare. And our guest, Andrew Stewart, has done a lot of work and research in this area. He's an assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. Andrew is also a licensed clinical social worker. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What are you wondering about ageism? Have you experienced age-based discrimination in the healthcare setting? Tell us how you think we could stop it. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Andrew Stewart, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I imagine there's some sort of legal definition or maybe of ageism. How do you define it?
Well, the definition of ageism is pretty simple. It's any prejudice, bias, or discrimination based solely on someone's age. So I actually think that's important to define ageism simply because it doesn't only affect older adults. There's actually a lot of research showing that ageism can affect younger people too.
Yeah. Maybe give us some examples of age-based discrimination in the healthcare field. You've certainly looked into it.
Yeah, there are many types of ageism. So we can think about the different types at different levels. So at kind of a more macro level, there is institutional ageism, which refers to the laws, policies, norms, and practices of institutions that unfairly restrict opportunities and systematically disadvantage people based on age. And an example of institutional ageism is that it actually wasn't until 2019 that the National Institutes of Health required that older adults be included in clinical trials. Some other examples are that only 2% of hospitals have geriatric emergency departments, and only 5 out of 145 medical schools have geriatric departments. So those are some examples of ageism in institutions.
Well, and you've talked about it in terms of economic loss. How is ageism related to economic loss?
Yeah, so it's interesting because a lot of ageism is really rooted in our own fears of aging. And then economically, you know, ageism is kind of rooted in this fear that older adults are a burden in on our economy. However, the research shows that ageism is associated with 17 million cases of the 8 most expensive health conditions in the United States, which when you put that to numbers, that was ageism is associated with 1 year economic cost of $63 billion. Ooh. Or another way to put it is 1 out of every $7 spent on those 8 most expensive health conditions in the U.S. So even though a lot of ageism really comes from our fear of aging and fear of older adults being a burden on our economy, the fact is that if we address ageism, we can actually save a lot of money. So
Mike is driving along in his semi and has a comment. So before he gets out of range, let's get Mike on the air. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I think I experienced what you guys were talking about here. I lost my brother to lung cancer, and my provider said that maybe, you know, I should be taking this test just to make sure that I'm okay. And I waited for an appointment and waited, and several weeks went by, nothing happened, and I called his office, and I was informed that because I'm 78 years old, that the test is no longer available for me. Had I been 77, they would have gave me the test. Well, I guess they're just kicking me to the curb and writing me off because I'm 78 years old.
Oh, boy. Well, Andrew, I'm sure you got a comment on that.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for medical providers to make recommendations based on someone's age. So, you know, in a lot of cases, I don't think it really makes sense. Like Mike's example, you know, whether you're 77 or 78, why should that make a difference? I really think it comes back to the patient themselves should be the ones to, you know, tell their doctor what they need, what matters to them. And so, you know, another example is that some of the guidelines around mammograms are that generally older women should get a mammogram every year as long as they have a life expectancy of 10 years, which I'm not sure how exactly anyone defines whether you have a life expectancy of 10 years. But even if you had a life expectancy of 9 years, why wouldn't you get a mammogram? I don't quite understand that. Maybe I'm missing something. But yeah, that's Mike's example is a really clear example.
Yeah, Carol in Green Bay has something for us as well. Carol, hello.
Hello. Hello. I found something that I observed myself. I had the same family doctor for 30 years, and I had an annual physical every year, complete physical, undressed, head to toe, entire exam, and all of a sudden when I turned 65, I got weighed, I had my blood pressure checked, I had my nurse ask me a few questions, I remained fully clothed, my doctor came in for just a few minutes, he listened over my clothing to my heart and lungs, pushed around on my abdomen, asked me if I had any problems, and out the door he went. So the examination when you're Medicare age is quite different. It's not as thorough, and echoing what Andrew said, you have to bring up problems to your doctor because they're not going to go looking for anything once you're 65. It all changes.
Hmm. Comment on that, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, another very clear example of ageism. Again, that you know, age, the age of 65, as if that really should make a difference in how thorough your physical is. Doesn't make sense to me. I think it's just rooted in ageism because there's this really irrational assumption that older people are, you know, maybe have already lived a long life, and so they shouldn't receive the same amount of comprehensive healthcare services. It really doesn't make sense. I mean, people are living longer and healthier lives anyway. Why are we using age as a determining factor for the amount of care people receive?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Carol, for calling. And Mary Kay in Kenosha will give you a chance. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. Institutional ageism has been going on for a long time, okay? I remember in the 90s, I was in my 30s, and I was in a nursing program. They took me out. They put other people in from other countries, okay? We are a threat. Older people are a threat to the drug companies, doctor appointments. And that's why there's ageism. It's because they're afraid. The teachers are, I mean, the schools are teaching doctors how to push pills instead of nutrition. So we are a threat to the drug company.
Andrew, what do you think about that? Thank you, Mary Kay.
Well, I think that's a good point. You know, it might come as a surprise to a lot of listeners, but Medicare actually, this is another example, Medicare actually doesn't cover hearing or dental or routine vision exams. So that doesn't make sense either. And And the, why would they do that? Well, it likely is the cost, right? Because pretty much everyone, really of any age, needs that kind of health care. But trying to save costs, but really not supporting older folks.
How long have researchers and social workers known about ageism in the healthcare field? Is this kind of a new thing or not?
Yeah, you know, ageism is a topic that has been coming of age, so to speak, more recently. I don't think it was really talked about too much. One of the first researchers to talk about it and define it was Robert Butler. I believe that was back, forgetting the exact date, but around 1971 or so.
Sure.
But it wasn't really until recently that people started talking about it more and talking about ageism kind of within a conversation of social justice as well. And so that's something else that's being talked about a lot more. How does ageism intersect with other social justice issues like racism or sexism or discrimination that LGBT folks experience? So all of these kinds of conversations are happening a lot more. There definitely is a growing movement, but we need to really advance the discussions that we're having to bring more awareness.
And, you know, just listening to our callers so far, you get such a when you get negative feelings like that as a patient, to me, that would have some impact on health, on your own health.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of ageism. So one of the types of ageism is called internalized ageism. So it's this idea that, you know, if an individual comes to believe that some of the myths or stereotypes about aging are true, it can kind of be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, for example, if an older adult or really anyone of any age believes in the negative stereotypes around aging, and it causes them to think that it's not worth it to engage in healthy lifestyle, you know, that can create a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of our health outcomes. So, yeah, the way we perceive our own aging is directly related to a number of health outcomes.
And I think ageism is widely accepted. Is it not? And I think it's also kind of hard to see sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is very prevalent and largely accepted, largely unchallenged. Again, I think because it's a somewhat new topic for a lot of people, we really haven't been talking about it too much until recently. So I think that, you know, there's a lack of consciousness around it. It's interesting for me in some of the work that I do, it's not uncommon for me to hear when I talk with older adults, sometimes they say things like, well, I don't think I've experienced ageism. But then as we talk more about it, we learn more about it, provide examples, they share with me later, oh, actually I have experienced ageism. So it just shows that, you know, education, learning more about this topic can really help to kind of unveil the reality that is all around us.
And just going along with your comment, your last comment there, I think just discussing it today is going to be, I think there are probably going to be a lot of people or many people who are listening who might just say, oh, yeah, I guess that is ageism. We can give some more concrete examples as we visit with our guest, Andrew Stewart. He's an assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. He's also a licensed clinical social worker and has a paper out, Age Discrimination in Healthcare, The Argument for a Multi-Level Intersectional Response, a really interesting paper. I read it, and we have it up on our we'll have it up on our page today. If you go to talk at WPR.org/Larry, you'll find it under today's date, a link to it. Larry Mueller here with my guest Andrew Stewart. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at ageism in the healthcare field with our guest Andrew Stewart, Larry Mueller here. And I'm hoping you'll join in with your own experiences. Have you experienced age-based discrimination in a healthcare setting? What are you wondering about ageism? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. .org. I was thinking about my own experiences. I guess it's not always apparent, but sometimes it'll be apparent with maybe somebody new in the healthcare field that I might be working with, and they notice my own age and so forth. And I have coped with it a little bit by dropping in somewhere along the line that I'm working full time and I have a radio show, and it does seem to make a difference. Almost right away in how people, a particular individual might respond to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of our values in our society are based on, being productive members of society, contributing to the economy. So, sometimes those first impressions or stereotypes related to age can be counteracted by demonstrating that older adults are contributing, continue to contribute in a variety of ways in later life.
Does seem to be kind of widely accepted, though, doesn't it? Well, ageism? I mean, and so a lot of times hard to see.
Yeah, it is widely accepted. It is hard to see, which is why I think if we provide more education and talk about it more, we'll learn to see it more.
Yeah. And you'd think in the healthcare field, it would be just the opposite. You'd think people in the healthcare field would be clued in.
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes back to if the fact is that only 5 out of 145 of our medical schools in the U.S. have geriatric departments, less than 10% require geriatric training. In my field in social work, there's been research showing that only about 1 in 10 social work students have expressed a clear interest in working with older adults. But the reality is a lot of social workers work in healthcare settings, and 90% of healthcare social workers work with older adults. So we really need to ramp up the training across the board for all medical professionals to have competence in working with older people.
Yeah. Susan in Monona will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling, Susan.
You're welcome. Nice to hear your voice, Larry. I have several examples, and I first noticed ageism taking my parents in for doctor appointments and having a healthcare professional direct everything to me. So I would not make eye contact with them, and I'd look at my parent. So they would address them. And another thing was when I turned 65, it was similar to what another caller said. Suddenly I'm not being touched other than a very cursory listening to my lungs, looking at my throat. And if I brought something up, I heard the phrase many times, well, as we age, this is normal. Whereas in the past, there might have been more testing or curiosity or exploration.
Susan, thanks a lot. She raises a few points here, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. Those are great examples and similar in some ways to prior callers. I want to address this as we age, or sometimes medical providers will say, well, that's normal at your age, which is kind of, it's dismissing very real concerns about our health, which can lead to under-treatment. But on the flip side, sometimes medical providers can make assumptions that people need a treatment simply because of their age. So that can lead to overtreatment. So that's unfortunate that both of those issues can happen.
Pat emailed us, and she says, Pat, age is just a number, and wonders how much of a role do the insurance providers play in affecting our views and attitudes?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure that I've looked too much into insurance other than, as I mentioned, Medicare, unfortunately, does not cover dental or hearing, and then also doesn't cover routine vision exams. And then also, you know, in terms of a lot of the insurance supports for older adults are based in Medicaid. And so we've got kind of this patchwork of, you know, Medicaid type of supports for older people. And, you know, it looks different in different states. It's not streamlined. So I think we really need Medicare for all. This is a great example why I think we need Medicare for all. And we need to advocate for new legislation. So I want to mention there's currently a bill that's been introduced called the Medicare Dental Vision and Hearing Benefit Act. There's also legislation called the Medicaid Dental Benefit Act. So these are legislations that people can, you know, advocate for to make things better for older adults.
Dennis emailed, I think with some experience on this, some ageism is, you can read it in outdated medical textbooks. These things can be taught in medical schools. Clinicians believe so-called facts are eternally proven.
Yeah, that's a good point. It speaks to why it can be problematic to make a decision about someone's care simply based on a number, their age. And again, people are living longer and healthier lives, so we do need to update, you know, the recommendations. Also, you know, there's different theories to why ageism has come up in our society. One of the theories is, you know, based in the biomedical model of care. And that sort of contributed to this narrative of aging as just decline, physical decline. So I think it's important that we need to think about older adults and all people, you know, as aging is something we're all experiencing from the time we're born. It's the one thing that we all have in common. It's not just physical. Yes, there are real changes that can happen as we age. It's important to acknowledge that. But, you know, aging is not just physical. It's also social and spiritual. And, you know, there's a lot of aspects to our aging. So thinking about and talking about older people in a more holistic way can help us to have more positive views of older people.
Yeah. I should mention later on in the show at our next segment, we're going to be talking about falls and how to avoid them. And so I'm looking forward to that as well. Tim in Whitewater has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, your guest mentioned Medicare for all, or some people call it universal health care. And I've been told by people from who have visited other countries or have family there that even in other countries that have universal health care, like Canada and Great Britain, Australia, or Europe, there is always a secondary market for insurance, secondary coverage that, you know, covers stuff that, you know, that are some of the supposed negatives about universal health care. And I wondered if your guest had any knowledge of that or any thoughts on that.
All right, Tim, thank you. Andrew, any thoughts?
So Tim mentioned secondary coverage. Not sure exactly what that is referring to. So I know there are different types of, you know, there's Medicare Part A, Part B, Part D, there's Medicare Advantage plans and in the U.S. And so, you know, that's our current Medicare system is far from perfect. And so you know, simply advocating for Medicare for all is not going to solve all of our problems, because we do need to tighten up and offer more comprehensive services through Medicare itself. So, yeah, that's important to acknowledge. So thank you to Tim for bringing up that question.
Lynn emailed us. She says she believes she has experienced ageism. She's a 61-year-old woman, employed full-time, and considers herself internet savvy. She researches her own medical issues on an accredited website. At her doctor visit, she poses her questions and concerns regarding the choice of treatments. And her doctor scolded her and told her she should ask her questions and not do her own research.
Wow. Well, that is not good. So, you know, if possible, if you currently have a medical provider that's scolding you, telling you not to do your own research, I hope it's within the realm of your possibilities to seek out a different medical provider, because that does not sound like a positive relationship with that provider.
Yeah, for sure. Patricia in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Patricia.
Aloha, Gary. I'm so upset. Aloha, Larry and guests. My concern is a well-known hospital here in Milwaukee treated me after I fell on a vacation in Europe, and they treated me and discharged me twice. I went back to the hospital for surgery, and following surgery, 2 days later, I had a grand mal seizure, which is currently called a tonic-clonic. I was discharged from the hospital instead of staying at the hospital rehab. And I went to a home, my home, with no food, nothing in the refrigerator, no wheelchair. And I went to a neurologist who is independent of that hospital. And he said, had they treated me the first time and the second time, they should have hospitalized me and treated me to prevent a seizure.
Boy, Patricia, thank you for calling. Comment, Andrew.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing your story, Patricia. You know, I think part of what Patricia's story highlights is that we really don't have adequate supports for people around health-related issues for you know, at their homes. So, you know, a lot of people really prefer to age in place. And of course, a lot of people, as Patricia's example highlights, you know, we all at times have to go to a hospital, see a doctor, we might have to get surgery, and then come back home. And this is a huge area that's lacking in our healthcare system, is providing supports for people at their homes, in their communities, and that sort of continuity of care from hospital back to home. So, yeah, that's a really, thank you for Patricia for sharing your example. I'm really sorry that happened to you.
Me too. I appreciate it very much, Patricia, and thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@wpr.org. I did want to get into a few more aspects of your paper, Andrew. You mentioned the word elder speak, and maybe you could talk about what you mean there.
Yeah. So elder speak is basically baby talk. So talking to an older person in an infantilizing way. So some examples are using terms like dear or sweetie, using simplified language, a sing-song tone, or immediately talking louder with an older person. So assuming that they need you to talk louder, rather than asking them, you know, are you hard of hearing? Would it be helpful for you if I spoke louder or slower? So making those assumptions in a way that affects the language we use and how we actually speak with older people.
So in other words, you should speak the way you'd speak to anybody else.
Exactly. Yeah. You can always ask someone, just like anyone of any age.
Yeah.
You know, and ask them what would be helpful in the way that we communicate.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathy in Middleton will give you a chance. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I am so thrilled. I was driving home from a doctor's appointment when I heard your show. I am old. I am so old. I'm too old to be alive, according to my former provider. What I should say is I am old, and I'm retired, and I had a fantastic job that used my mind, and I used it well. Okay, I had an accident, broke my back, had another accident, broke my hip, had another accident, broke my femur, all unrelated. I still am in recovery after years, but I'm treated as if I'm a drug seeker because I have pain. Of course, when you're in pain, chronic pain, you're a drug seeker. Okay, so here this former primary whom I must say I liked him. I really liked him very much. He was telling me he wanted to send me to a SNF. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do in a SNF? I'm going to sit there and I'm going to die. Because it was, you know, there's no intellectual stimulation there. You're old and you're just expected to look forward to tapioca pudding and bingo. And I am just so angry the way I am treated and minimized and marginalized because I am old. They don't stop to think, what can this woman do for society? What can she give? What does she need? And I, no disrespect to your guest, social workers, in my estimation, are a scourge on the society because they want to put you in a program that puts you on the state, on some sort of a dole, on a program that keeps other social workers and other people busy. You know, physical therapy means you stand in place and march. I was actually denied physical therapy because I was too old for it, and I needed physical therapy. I had to find it myself, and I had to implement my own program. Thank heavens I'm able to do that. But I'm finding that I had to fight the system. The system does not like me because I speak up. I'm an advocate for myself. And doggone it, I'm going to live a whole lot longer than they want me to because I am not going to a SNF.
Well, Kathy raises some points there, Andrew. Comments?
Well, part of what Kathy mentioned, she mentioned pain. And her pain being dismissed by medical providers. So I want to highlight that because that is quite common. You know, going back to the, it's not uncommon for medical providers to say things like, well, at your age, this is normal. You know, and that is particularly common for women to experience. So that's an example of how ageism might intersects with sexism, perhaps. So so that is quite common, and that's important to call out. So thank you to Kathy for advocating for herself and for older adults in general. Yeah, I think social work is a really important and valuable field. So a lot of us social workers are doing things to advocate against ageism. So but I do hear what Kathy's saying, that the system is really not set up and designed for older people. And that's important to acknowledge.
She mentioned SNF, and I believe, and for those who may not be familiar, I think that means skilled nursing facility.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So there you go. Another point you make before we go back to the phones, you make a point about rationing, and I get we've kind of I think talked about this, but maybe to define that a little more carefully or clearly.
Sure. Yeah. So, healthcare rationing is a controversial topic. So probably a clear example. If we think back to the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was concern that we would not have enough ventilators. across the country. For example, the state of Alabama decided to ration ventilators on the basis of age. And that was later found to be an example of age discrimination. So a lot of times healthcare rationing happens on the basis of age because, in a time of crisis, sometimes the healthcare system feels it needs to make decisions quickly to triage our resources, and making a decision based on age is a very quick way to do that. But I would say it's quite problematic, and we need to incorporate a wide variety of factors and really put the needs of each individual first.
Our guest today, Andrew Stewart, you can join in too with your questions as we talk about ageism in the healthcare field. Andrew, of course, assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee and as a licensed clinical social worker. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at ageism in the healthcare field with our guest, Andrew Stewart, assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee and a licensed clinical social worker. Great to have him with us, and great to hear comments from you as well as you listen in. Appreciate it. Barbara emailed us. She wanted to point out that Medicare does not cover annual physicals. What they will cover is something called an annual wellness visit, and that's probably what some of our callers experienced after age 65. And I think that's correct. I'm pretty sure that's correct, Andrew.
Well, that would make sense given the experiences people have shared on this show.
Yeah. Sam and Mellon, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi, Sam.
Hi, good morning. My wife is a retired nurse practitioner, and she has a degree in human sexuality. She did her dissertation on how doctors treat sexual complaints in patients over 50. And basically, it was that men got Viagra and women got lubricant. And that was it. And we haven't seen a lot of change. So I'd like for your guest to maybe talk about what he sees and how people are treated for sexual complaints.
Andrew? Mm-hmm.
That is a great point. Thank you, Sam, for bringing that up. And you're exactly right. That's one of the stereotypes around aging. That's an example of ageism. Stereotypes that older adults are not sexually active.
This is Clara. Are you Susan?
So this is a really important topic.
Well, hi, Susan.
There's a lot of ways that this is important. I think, another example is inadequate care related to menopause for women and lack of understanding in some respects of experiences that men have as they age. As your guest mentioned, for men, it's also just kind of prescribing Viagra. There's a lot of unique experiences men have as well as we age. So it's not an area that I've done extensive research on, but it is a critical area related to ageism.
Thanks again for that call. Carol in Madison, it's your turn.
Okay, I'm 51 years old. At 51 years old, I actually had an injury, and post-injury, I had gained 56 pounds. Now, the doctor I went into said, well, what do you expect? You're a middle-aged woman. And he hadn't looked at my history. I've bicycled through Europe. I'm a canoeist. I swim. Anyways, and so it took 4 years to get the correct diagnosis. I had lymphedema from the injury. And the other speaker, or the caller that said she was in pain, it could be because you have edema that's causing severe pain. And I actually was referred to a physiatrist, a doctor of physical medicine, after this other visit, and I wasn't happy with it. And she said if I didn't want to take drugs for my pain, that it was all psychological. And so she said she referred me to a psychologist, which was not available for 3 months. And I just decided I have to figure this out for myself. So I finally found an alternative doctor that referred me to OT for lymphedema treatment. And it resolved. Everything resolved. I've lost at least 50 of those pounds anyhow. And then when I was 70, I had another experience. Post J&J 9 weeks, I woke up one morning with a severely swollen right ankle and foot, couldn't stand on it. And I went into ER for it, and they basically said, well, there's nothing wrong, you know, and that nothing in my note was mentioned about the post J&J vaccination. Since then, I've had one joint after another have severe swelling and deterioration, including a vertebrae coming out of position, so I could not even walk. I had to use a walker for 3 months, but I've resolved every single one of them. And my doctor, my new primary doc at about age 69, said, well, you're just wearing out.
Andrew, comment?
Yeah, thank you for sharing all of those examples. You know, a lot of examples that are very dismissive by medical providers. And again, going back to the pain being dismissed, I think that is really common. And again, I think some of those examples speak to the intersection of ageism with sexism, the way that people are treated differently based on both their age and their gender. And it's not uncommon for older women to, or really, I think all people, you know, for medical providers to kind of fall back on weight or BMI as well, rather than taking in a comprehensive assessment. So, thank you for sharing those examples.
As part of a solution, you know, we should talk about solutions here a bit, because you do talk about solutions. And she was demonstrating one solution in a way, and some others did too, in that they did some research and were not afraid to speak up.
Yeah, exactly. So I agree. You know, it's okay to tell your medical providers, can you please talk with me and ask me what my preferences are for care? And you can tell them, you know, can you tell me any time that you're making a recommendation based on my age? I would like to know about that. I would like to contribute to the decision around the type of care that's provided to me. Anytime you're making a recommendation based on my age. And then other than that, for solutions, you know, folks, the onus should not all be placed on individuals themselves. So folks out there can know that there are ombudsmen, which are advocates for older adults in certified healthcare settings, nursing homes, et cetera. And they're really your advocate. You can call them, go to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services to look for your ombudsman in your area. There are also aging and disability resource centers. I would say they are the number one place to go to for a wide range of aging-related concerns. And then also, I think we really need to change our entire culture, our entire environments and healthcare settings. So some ways we can do this are, there's a national movement called Age-Friendly Health Systems that really are putting older adults' needs at the center of all decisions around care. And in Wisconsin, there's also the Consumer-Directed Care Network of Wisconsin. So really getting to more of a person-directed approach to care. So I think all of these things can also help, as well as individuals, you know, during their research and advocating and talking with their doctors, because we really shouldn't be putting all the burden on individuals themselves We need to increase supports and change the entire kind of environment.
I'm wondering, and maybe you can talk about this, where do you did mention age-friendly health systems, but where do age-friendly health care systems exist, and how can you tell if an establishment is one?
Oh, that's a great question. So you can go to age-friendly health systems. You can go to the John A. Hartford Foundation. Search for John A. Hartford Foundation, age-friendly health systems, and they have a really useful map of the entire United States where you can just see all the dots across the country. I know we have several in the Milwaukee area, so that's where folks could go to see whether their healthcare practice is associated with an age-friendly health system.
Yeah. What kinds of cultural changes need to happen in healthcare?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of our healthcare systems, again, are kind of rooted in this biomedical model, which in part has led to healthcare systems being somewhat institutional, somewhat cold. And so some ways we need to change our culture are, for example, I used to work at a retirement community in Denver that was really at the front of culture change. They embraced what was called an initiative called the Eden Alternative, which is part of a larger movement through an organization called Pioneer Network. But that was all about changing the environment and culture of nursing homes away from institutional setting to a truly a home and community for people. And so, you know, what they say is that we can't just measure the success and the outcomes of healthcare systems, including nursing homes, through medical criteria. So they actually say in the Eden Alternative model that the real plagues in nursing homes are actually loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. And so their approach is really all about promoting community, promoting person-directedness, promoting citizenship so that each individual within a healthcare setting has the opportunity to contribute. So these are some ways that we can change the culture in healthcare.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I read your paper. And by the way, we're going to put that map that you mentioned, we'll put that up as a link as well on today's page so that if people want to find an age-friendly health system in their area, hopefully they'll be able to see it on that link. And we'll put that up after the show. I think about an hour or so after the show is over, we'll have that up. And policy changes in the last minute or so, what kinds of policy changes should we consider?
Well, as I mentioned, there are a couple of legislation that people can advocate for. There's a Medicare Dental Vision and Hearing Benefit Act. There's the Medicaid Dental Benefit Act so that all older people can have access to receiving dental vision and hearing supports. And then I think we need to include older adults in clinical trials, so that our healthcare recommendations and practices are really understanding the needs of older people that's rooted in research. You know, then I think we really just need to, I think more broadly, we need to think about the health of our entire kind of culture and to think about how important, you know, an indicator of the health of any culture is how we treat young people and elders. And so I really think we all need to reflect about that. Think about how we, what we believe about our own aging. And that's one step we can all take to changing the entire culture around aging.
Andrew, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Andrew Stewart, Assistant Professor of Social Work at UW-Madison, also a licensed clinical social worker. Obviously, we could talk some more about this, and we will down the road. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.